All right, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Office Hours. I'm your host, Daniel Pink, broadcasting from our state-of-the-art facility here in the heart of Washington, D.C., the capital of what is left of the United States of America. Here's how Office Hours works. We still got a lot of people coming in here now, too, which is awesome. Here's how Office Hours works. On each program, we open the phone lines for an hour, and then I, accompanied by a special guest, about whom more in a moment, will take your questions, questions about work, business, life, management, creativity, sports, romance, food, anything you want. If you have questions, we'll try to offer some answers. This radio-ish show we think of as Car Talk, but for the human engine, Car Talk for the human engine. And today we've got a great guest, a really great guest, the click to my clack, Marcus Buckingham. Now, for those of you who don't know Marcus, I'm shocked. You should be ashamed of yourself. He is one of the leading management thinkers of our day, and he's a pioneer, in some ways the pioneer, of the strength revolution. Let me just explain that very briefly. We're going to talk more to Marcus about that in a moment. It used to be that management and personal development were all about fixing weaknesses. But a group of scholars, along with a few bold practitioners like Marcus, over the last decade or so, have really reoriented our thinking. They've showed in a compelling and very empirical way that we're actually better off tapping our strengths, intensifying where we're strong rather than single-mindedly trying to repair where we're weak. It's been a revolutionary idea, and Marcus has led the charge in speaking and consulting around the world, and as co-author of the book, Now Discover Your Strengths, which has sold, I did a quick check of the publishing database, it's sold roughly 5 gazillion copies since it came out a decade ago, and sent equal numbers of people to take the Strengths Finder assessment. Now Marcus is out with a really, really interesting new book. It's called Standout. And it introduces a next-generation assessment and takes the whole notion of strengths into the future. So, Marcus, welcome to Office Hours.
Thank you for having me, Dan, or Click, as I shall now be referring to you.
Am I Click
or are you Clack? I can't remember.
I think I'll be Clack.
Okay.
I think Click Pink doesn't sound quite right. Clack Pink, that doesn't sound very good either. Clack Buckingham actually doesn't sound too bad.
Okay, from now on, please, anyone refer to me as Clack Buckingham. I think that's...
Yeah,
I think we should,
in print, it should be Marcus and then quotation, Clack Buckingham. where are you today, Marcus?
I am in sunny, actually cloudy, Southern California. I was in Kiawah Island yesterday, so flew in. I've never been to South Carolina, my first trip, really enjoyed it, and then flew in late last night, and so... We have children running off to school, and I'm, in my house, Southern California.
All right. Excellent. Okay. We're going to take some questions. I'm going to ask you some questions. But folks out there in radio land, if you want to ask a question, just press star 2. All the folks who are listening to the iTunes rebroadcast, please don't try this. It's not going to work. But if you're listening live... press star 2 if you'd like to ask a question. Don't press star 2 just willy-nilly. If you want to ask a question, ask Marcus a question, press star 2. That will allow our crack team of producers to see you on the control panel, and then I'll say your name, something like Fred in St. Louis, you're on the air, and you can ask away. In the last few episodes, which is really kind of cool, people kind of organically began asking questions via Twitter, and that's fine too. Just include my Twitter handle, which is @DanielPink, so we'll be able to see it. We don't have a separate Office Hours hashtag, but we're just going to use @DanielPink as a way if you have a question via Twitter. And we already have people lining up to ask Marcus questions here. We're also, and this is where it gets really exciting, and this is where I feel like a genuine radio host, Marcus. We're also giving away 24 copies of Standout, Marcus's really, really interesting new book. And so here's what we're going to do. If we take your call, You'll get a free book shipped to your doorstep. For the remainder, we're going to announce a drawing at the end of the program. So if you want to ask a question, again, it's star two. That'll allow us to see you raise your hand, and then we'll try to take as many questions as we can. But first, some questions of my own.
Sure.
Marcus, for those who need a little bit of background, tell us about kind of the strengths movement, the strengths revolution. Take us through the big idea about strengths, where it came from, and what it means.
Well, the basic notion of a strengths-based approach to performance, Dan, comes actually from all of the work that we did while I was at Gallup studying great managers. And if you line up all the managers against the wall, of course you'd find out that they're all really different from one another, they're different styles and different approaches. But if you had one thing in common and you were to say what was that they had in common, it would be this notion that, as I wrote in First Break All the Rules originally, it's that you don't try and put in what was left out. You try and draw out what was left in, that you get more bang, as it were, more return on your investment from finding where a person has some natural gifts and strengths and then cultivating and refining those, and then you manage around their areas of weakness. Peter Drucker obviously said the same thing about companies. I think his phraseology was you get your strengths together and make your weaknesses irrelevant as a company. And
right.
David Ricardo, the British economist in the late 18th century, said the same thing about countries. He actually posited the law of comparative advantage, that you find
Very
your comparative
point.
Advantage and then you leverage it. And really, I think great managers realized that, I mean, instinctively realized that your strengths counter to what is often put into performance management systems and appraisals, your strengths are your greatest areas of opportunity for growth. So you don't have strengths on one end of the continuum and then weak and then sort of areas of opportunity on the other end. You have strengths, which are your areas of opportunity, and then you have weaknesses, which need to be mitigated and dealt with, but are certainly not your greatest areas of opportunity. They're probably the areas where you'll be least resilient and least creative and least innovative. Your strengths, on the other hand, are the places where when you take training and development and coaching and you invest them in someone's strengths, you get an exponential return on your investment in the form of creativity, innovation, and so on. So that,
right.
in
it's
a nutshell, is the basic insight.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. And actually, I don't remember reading in the book or making the David Ricardo – I think the David Ricardo analogy is really quite interesting because it is really about – it really is about comparative advantage. It's sort of go with what you're good at and hold that and hold – in some ways and hold off the rest. And the work that you did at Gallup earlier in your career I think has had a huge, huge influence on – companies and individuals. I can speak myself. I've done strengths finders, and I even had our two daughters, our now 15-year-old, now 12-year-old, do the assessment for kids to find out, you know, what are their strengths, and how can we start talking about those. But we already have a question, Marcus, over the Twitter already, and it's funny they addressed it to Marcus Clack Buckingham. So this new moniker is sticking. And it's from Joy Meredith, and she asked an interesting question. She says, do strengths change over time? Are they consistent over time? If I'm strong on something when I'm 15, am I going to be strong on the same thing when I'm 35 or 55?
Well, your personality doesn't change much over the course of your life. If you are ordered and structured at 15, you're going to be ordered and structured at 35. If you have a natural feeling for empathy at 15, you're going to have the same natural sense of other people's emotions at 35. What changes, of course, are two things. You change your skills, so you can change what you know how to do, how to apply that empathy or structure, and you can change your experience. So the experience in the form of your values, those will, of course, change over the course of your life, and you can change your perspective on yourself. So the experience that you get in living with your empathy and understanding that works for you, you can become less defensive. You can become more accepting of who you are. You can become more sophisticated as you figure out how to channel who you are. So the things that change in the course of your life are experience and skills. Your natural recurring patterns of thought or feeling or behavior or emotion, those things don't change over the course of your life.
Okay, I see that. Okay, that makes sense. And do you? I wonder yourself. I mean, did you have a notion of? Let's go back to Marcus at 15. Did you have a notion of what your own strengths were back then, or was it something that you can look back on retrospectively and understand that?
You know, I don't think I knew exactly what I wanted to do at 15. I had spent the first few years of my life, well, up until about 12, not being able to speak. I had a stammer from 0 to 12. And so most of my early life was spent just worrying about the fact that I would never marry anybody because I couldn't say the word marry. And so at that point, I was still, I think, like any 12 to 13-year-old, sort of seized up with my own preoccupations of how on earth do I fit in and not
right.
come across as an outsider and a prune. And then I had always, and then magically one day, for various reasons, my stammer completely went away in the course of about a week. And I then did begin to realize that I was constantly volunteering to stand up on stage and speak. I still wasn't very articulate in talking to people one-on-one, but if you gave me a really big audience, like in chapel or like in school assembly or even a school play, I did consistently volunteer for that.
Interesting.
So there was a sense, I suppose, of that. And then I was always intrigued by human difference. I always liked the answer, it depends.
Mm.
So if you were to say, why does someone do X versus Y? The answer I would always give is, it depends. And I suppose that human individuality has always been something that's intrigued me.
Yeah, interesting. So we have another question here from Andrea Meyer. She asks, she wants to know what your, Marcus's, Clack Buckingham's, what's your own strengths profile? I guess she's talking about the StrengthsFinder, I'm assuming.
Well, with StrengthsFinder, my top two or top three or four are futuristic, which is, wouldn't it be great if? It's context, which is how do we get here?
Interesting.
So I often look at the present. It's focus, so I like to do one thing at a time.
Right.
I don't like to do things in parallel. I like to do them in series. And then I've got ideation, which is a need to find concepts, and then intellection, which is a need to be by yourself a lot, to ruminate on things.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah.
And you want to, fascinating. All right. So that's another question. I actually took it, and even though Andrea Meyer didn't ask me, I'm going to tell you anyway. I came out number one, strategic. And then the rest were ideation, like yours, ideation, learner, and input. And I was telling Marcus earlier that as a writer, I really wanted communication to be high on there, but it wasn't. It's a fascinating thing. It really gives people vocabulary to discuss their own lives and understand, you know, how they can do better. Let's talk about the new book here. We have a lot of questions here, Marcus. I want to get to listener questions here. And if you want to ask a question, listeners, just hit star 2. That'll allow you to raise your hand virtually, and our crack team of producers will see you, and then we'll honor you. Let's talk about the new book, because the new book, and it's called Standout. It just came out this week. It's already on fire. Last time I checked, it was in the top, I don't know, 10 on Amazon, top 5 on Amazon. And you came up with, over the last few years, with a new assessment here. Tell us about the driving force behind the book Standout and this new assessment and your attempt to sort of move the conversation on strengths to a deeper level.
Well, the focus of Standout, by the way, one of my strengths is not organization and structure. I managed to pick up my phone, and my phone is now running down on batteries. So I'm going to call in on a different line, and hopefully you can still hear me.
Okay, so
I'm actually good now because I just did an amazing technological thing and switched phones without cutting you off, which is extraordinary to me.
You know what? That's a first in office hours. That's a first in office hours history. Fortunately, we're recording it, so it will be preserved for posterity. So thank you, Marcus.
My pleasure.
So tell us. So thank you for doing that. Tell us about Standout and where it came from, and how it takes this strengths movement, the strengths revolution, in a really intriguing and promising new direction.
Well, what I was interested in with Standout was, how do you pinpoint, to go back to David Ricardo, how do you pinpoint a person's comparative advantage? If things like StrengthsFinder, and indeed other personality profiles like a Myers-Briggs or a DISC, if they were to describe a person, and that was their point, to describe you, we wanted with StrengthsFinder to describe you in affirming terms, strengths-based terms, but its purpose was to describe who you are. The next question beyond that, obviously, is, well, how do I win? How do I actually apply that? If StrengthsFinder took you apart and said, ooh, look at all the bits and pieces of you, then with Standout, I wanted to say, let's find a way to put you back together. Let's find a way to put you back together and say, when you apply yourself in any position you happen to be in, what is your edge? So we took all of the available research that we had on all the different ways in which you can slice and dice someone and said, how do these come together? How do these come together into predictable patterns? Can we identify those patterns that are most predictive of performance, whether in leadership or management or sales or service? Can we identify those patterns? And we found 9. And then let's design an instrument that enables you, once you've taken it, to pinpoint your top 2 so that you can remember them. One of the challenges with StrengthsFinder was always that people could never quite remember what their top 5 were. And if you can't remember something, you can't really consciously apply it. So can we help you figure out your top 2 and then have those come together into what we call the comparative advantage? So what's your edge? And then feed you, the hope anyway, then to feed you innovations, ideas, tips, tricks that could help you apply that comparative advantage. So whereas my previous work was descriptive in its goal, let's describe you, we wanted this to be prescriptive. Here's what you should go do. If you're going to be a manager, this is the kind of manager you're going to be. If you're going to be in sales, this is the way you'll win in sales. If you're going to be in leadership, this is going to be the kind of leader that you are. This shouldn't say that you are prevented from being any one of those things. It should simply say, if you're going to be anything, any one of those roles or any one of those positions, this is the way in which you're going to have your greatest impact. So I wanted it to focus really on, well, what on earth do I do to win?
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, one of the things I do like about this is that once one takes this assessment, the advice and the tools and takeaways are really tailored to whatever profile you test as. And it doesn't, segregate you into you should be this or you should be that. What it says is that, as Marcus was saying, is that, here's you at your most powerful. Here's how you, whatever profile you test, that can make an immediate impact. What I also like is, here's how you can apply this as a leader. Here's how you can apply this as a manager. Here's how you can apply this in sales. And I think that's really effective. Give us an idea about how, because I thought what was really interesting and I have to say somewhat frustrating about the instrument itself, give us an idea of some of the questions that you ask or how you do it. Because I think that the way that you ask the questions and even that kind of game show-like countdown timer makes this a really interesting instrument to experience.
Yeah, well, most of the assessments that I've built over the years have been attribute assessments. So you judge yourself, rate yourself on a list of qualities or attributes. So with StrengthsFinder, we had things like, are you a teacher? Are you a coach? Do you like to hang out with historians? Do you like to hang out with futurists? And then you would go through a list of these, and you'd rate yourself on these attributes. So the summary of your test was really a summary of how you see yourself. Well, with Standout, because we were interested in impact and action and what are you actually going to do, we didn't want to design a test that way. We wanted to design what is actually called in the business, it's called a situational judgment test, which means we throw situations at you, like, say, a friend of yours or a colleague of yours at work steals your idea and passes it off as your own, as her own. What would you do?
And then you give four options.
and we give you four options, and then we basically, with each scenario, say, what would you do? What would you do? What would you do? What would you do? And
yeah.
We've got a 35-second timer on there so that you don't have a chance to intellectualize. We just throw scenarios out there, none of which are obviously right or wrong, none of which, sadly, are obviously connected to any of the nine strengths roles that we measure you on. And there are an awful lot of decoys in there that don't actually measure anything at all. But the summary at the end, Dan, and why we wanted to design a test this way, the summary is a summary of what you would do. We give you 12 chances for each of those nine strengths roles to choose what you would do. And if your top two strengths roles come out as like-minded, creator, stimulator, that's because the 12 chances I got to hit a creator action, I hit it. I didn't know I was hitting it, but I hit it.
Yeah.
Which means your results are not really a summary of how you see yourself. Your results are a summary of what you would do repeatedly, which means that they probably capture how other people see you.
Can I stop you there? Can you just say that again? Because I think that is like the huge, big conceptual breakthrough here. It's not just give us that one more time, this idea that it's not about the attributes, it's about what you would do, how others would see you, and so forth. Because I think that's really the key here.
Well, if I'm going to capture how you're going to win, I've got to get to your behavior. I've got to get to your recurring behavior. So the test is built to capture your recurring top-of-mind behavior. And therefore, your results, when we sum them up, because the questions are non-obvious in terms of what they're linked to, you don't know which response is tied to which action, which strength role. The summary is a summary of what you would go do. What would you repeatedly do? And therefore, you at least, when you get your results, many people who take this, when they get their results, they're going to be surprised because they see themselves in a different way. But when you get your results, all I would ask is that people, you keep your mind open to the possibility that your top two strengths roles and their combination are how other people feel you when you sit down at a table. They're how other people react to you when you walk into a room. They are how other people see you. And you can either do that and behave in that way accidentally, or you can do it intentionally. And the point of this assessment was, well, why wouldn't you do it intentionally? If this is how you lead, if these two top two strengths roles capture how other people make sense of you as a leader, then why wouldn't you own that, be conscious of that, and then figure out a way to make it useful?
Right.
So that was
the
point of taking that approach with a situational judgment test.
Yeah, and I have to say, it's a really interesting, you know, I think a lot of people on this, a lot of people who are listening in are people, you know, I'm assuming many of them have taken Strengths Finders. I'm sure, you know, everyone in North America, it seems, has taken Myers-Briggs, that we have beginning to develop a kind of a literacy about some of these assessments. And I think some of them end up being very easy to game. You can say, oh, I know why they're asking this. This one is impossible to game. It completely befuddled me. And I was just answering the questions. And it ended up giving me as some results that I would have that surprised me and that actually became a little bit of a revelation. I tested the highest on the profile called advisor, which would have surprised me. Not what I would have predicted. But I can now, as I reflect a little bit, I say, oh, okay, this might be how people see me a little bit. And this might be how I actually behave in a situation. So I think the instrument is really, really, I mean, I think it's inherently interesting, and it's, to me, it's different in quality than a lot of the other kinds of instruments that I've taken. And because of that, I think it can yield some really powerful guidance here. Marcus, we have so many questions lined up here. I'm going to shut up and I'm going to go to the phones. If you
can I just,
go ahead.
Dan, can I just riff on one thing? Because when you took it, your top two were advisor, equalizer. And for those of you that are listening, if you're an advisor, your first question is always, what is the best thing to do? So you're practical, you're pragmatic, you think about what works, you think about words like effectiveness, and what actually is the best thing to do in any situation. Problems and conundrums are intriguing to you. So that's what advisor captures. Equalizer doesn't start with what's the best thing to do. Equalizers start with what is the right thing to do. So there's a moral order and structure to the universe, and people who have equalizer as their top one are people who we trust. They see the world in terms of black and white, in terms of this is right and this is wrong, and we trust you because you're predictable in your perspectives, and therefore you make relationships an awful lot easier because of that predictability. We know where you're coming from. Now, what that means for me is, I mean, I know that you maybe were surprised by those results, but having read your books and having seen you speak, and I'm just going to wade into this, and you can shoot me down if you like, but the reason
the gun is cocked to shoot you down here. Go ahead, Marcus.
I think the reason why you're effective when you speak and the reason why you're effective when you write is because you are authoritative, because you break something down into its steps and its component parts, and you tease it apart, and then you go, look how this plays out. Carrot and stick is not effective because look how this plays out. Now, let's play it out differently, and let's not play it out differently in theoretical terms. Let's play it out differently at the 5-foot level. Let's just play out a better way of doing things. And when you present it that way, you're not in doubt. I mean, you are clear and crisp in terms of what you think is the most effective outcome and why this particular sequence of steps leads to a better outcome. It's not theoretical. It's not flowery. It's not innovative for the sake of innovation. It's just, hey, this works better. And therefore, it seems persuasive and convincing because you're speaking from that position of assurance. And you put advisor and equalizer together. For me, that isn't much of a surprise because that's how you come across. You're not gimmicky. You're not I won't mention names. You have a solidity about you.
Please mention names. That's a very generous interpretation. The only thing I thought of when you say, you know, if I test it as high on kind of advisor and giving people advice and being a person of trust and this sense of equalizer, which is having a moral center, I thought, oh my gosh, please do not tell my mother that I tested advisor and equalizer, you know, trusted advisor and moral force, because she would call me up immediately and say, I knew you should have become a rabbi.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I think people trust you. That's why you probably had the position that you had in the course of your career. But it's also
you're being too kind here. Let's take some questions here. We got a lot of people raising their hands. I just want to give a shout out. We have a lot of folks coming in on Twitter. I want to give a shout out to a guy named Tom Catalini, who says, he's tweeted, I'm listening to Office Hours with my team and, quote, the world's largest coffee roll. So I just, I mean, we're going to be in, yeah, we're going to be in Guinness. So thanks to Tom. Okay, so we got a lot of calls lined up. We're not going to get to all of them. I'm going to shut up and we're going to go in here now. Let's go to Dawn Sawyer in Grand Prairie, Texas. Dawn, you're on with Marcus. What's your question?
Hi, the question I have is, I've been working with strengths-based teams, and we always see a marked drop in motivation after the annual sort of antiquated rack and stack comes out. So I'd like both of your perspectives on kind of maintaining performance when you're focusing on strengths, so you have a very motivated team, yet kind of dealing with, you know, those sort of antiquated performance systems that hit as part of every company.
Well, I guess I would wade into that one and say, I think I was actually just with a whole bunch of senior execs, senior HR execs last night and the night before. And all of the conversation was, let's get rid of all these rack and stacks. Let's get rid of all these performance management systems where people once a year get rated, they get given a ranking, and then we have to sort of defend that ranking with a description of why they did what they did. And the reason, of course, why that's such a waste of time, as you say, not only is it demotivating, but it's also irrelevant. You're rating someone at the end of the year where you can't do anything about what happened during the year. So it's a very retrospective approach to performance management. In fact, it doesn't manage performance at all. Probably the best way, if you personally can't just get rid of it all, which every company should, every rating, every ranking system, it should just go away. It's a waste of time. And detrimental. If you can't get rid of it because you're not in a position of authority to do that, then every year, once a year, unfortunately, suck it up and do it. And then to manage performance or accelerate performance, instead, turn it into something that you do once a quarter with your people. Once a quarter, do just a really simple one-pager, set the goals for the person, and then say, what are the strengths you're going to use to drive these goals? What's your path of least resistance to these goals? And then what are some of the weaknesses that we've got to do to manage around? Once a quarter, do it. And make it very informal, very focused on the person first, so that you're going, who are you, and then what's the focus for these next two or three months? If you're a publicly traded company, of course, financial analysts are looking at your company once a quarter, so why not do the same thing with your people?
Great.
Dawn, what I'm going to ask you to do here, forgive me this administrative thing here, is what I'm going to ask you to do is send in an email to this address here. You know what? I can't find the email address. We'll tell you later. We'll tell you later. You're going to get a free book. You're going to get a free copy of Standout. We'll figure it out later on, Dawn, okay?
Great.
Thanks for calling in. And I agree. I really want to second that motion that Mark has made about these forced ranking systems. I think are absolutely insidious. I mean, the idea that I think we're going to look back on these 20 years from now, 30 years from now, and say, what the heck were we thinking? I mean, they're just profoundly useless and I think demotivating for everybody. If you're at the top, you feel good for a moment, and then you worry you're going to lose your status. If you don't make it to the top, you feel like a loser for not being at the top. And if you're at the very bottom, you say, holy crap, I'm going to lose my job. And so it puts everybody, makes everybody feel worse rather than better. And as Mark is saying, it doesn't give you any meaningful feedback or information on your performance. I think that there are a whole array of things. We talked some of them in our last episode with Teresa Amabile and Stephen Kramer. There are a lot of other ways to provide rich, robust feedback at a faster metabolism inside of organizations. And I think if we can just get rid of these force ranking systems, we'll be better off. I'm actually surprised myself that they've endured for so long. Let's go back to the phones here. Let's go to where do you want to go? Jessica Lerner, our crack producer. Well, we're going to go to Randy. We're going to go to Randy in Philadelphia. Randy in Philadelphia. You're on the air with Marcus.
Yeah. Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Hey, Randy.
My question simply is, there seems you were talking earlier that things like empathy and personality traits are not skills. Is that right?
Yeah.
But it seems to me that as we develop strengths and as we gain these new perspectives, that they seem to be malleable to some degree.
Well, a skill, as I would define it, is something that you can break down into a sequence of steps. So to check somebody into a hotel is a skill that I can teach. To write a piece of computer code is a skill that I can teach. If I can break it down into a sequence of steps, Randy, then it's a skill. And to some extent, therefore, empathy would be a skill. You could say to somebody, look, here are the steps to making another a person feel heard. Number one, ask open-ended questions. Number two, keep quiet. And number three, every 30 seconds or so, say, uh-huh. I would probably take someone who's terrible at empathy and make them a little bit better than they were before. So in that sense, the skill is transferable. But the underlying ability to spontaneously sense somebody else's emotions through the cues that they're sending off, that's not teachable because it's not a sequence of steps.
Okay.
It's a natural recurring reaction to the world.
Let me follow it up with a clarifying statement. I understand I can't change the emotional reaction, but it seems to me that there is a lot of work being done on such as NLP and changing the stories that we tell ourselves in order to remove the threat response that allows us to reinterpret the feelings that we have.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's no question that you can change the stories that you tell yourself about why things worked or why they didn't work.
And isn't that the skill of becoming more empathy?
No, I think probably if you're changing the skill, if something worked out well for you or poorly for you, and you're changing the way you describe to yourself why that played out the way it did, that isn't changing who you are. It's changing the way that you interpret who you are. Now, that might lead to more productive behaviors.
Oh,
so you're less
okay.
defensive. You're less down on yourself.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
less depressed. But you don't become a different human being. You become somebody who has a better understanding of the human being you already are, which I think is
incredibly
valuable.
I mean, that's hugely valuable. That's the sort of self-knowledge that philosophers have always counseled us to develop since the days of Socrates. Thank you, Randy, for the question. You get a free copy of Marcus's new book, Standout. And again, we're talking with Marcus Buckingham, one of the pioneers, perhaps the pioneer of the strengths revolution. He's got a great new book out this week called Standout, that has a new groundbreaking strengths assessment that is really, really interesting. Let me just say a word about empathy. There's another analogy that I've used. And it has to do with empathy itself. Is that we have. You can look at this biologically in a way. Let's take something like all of us have ranges sort of in our DNA about certain kinds of things. So, you know, my DNA, based on the DNA that I have when I was a baby, if you had the systems to test that, you would say, okay, this guy is not going to be 6'10", and this guy is not going to be 5'5". Okay, this guy is going to be probably somewhere between, you know, 5'8", and six feet tall. Now, if he grows up fat and happy in Columbus, Ohio, he's going to go to the higher end of that spectrum. If he grows up in an impoverished area, he's going to be at the lower end of that spectrum. And I think that in some cases, empathy is sort of like that. That is, we have kind of natural inclinations. Some of us, but we can do things to help us, whether they're the sort of routine algorithmic things that you're describing, Marcus, we can do things to help move us to the higher end of our inherent range, which is both a form of self-improvement and a form of self-knowledge. Let's go back to the phones here. Let's go to Gloria in Camarillo, Camarillo, California. Gloria, you're on with Marcus.
Camarillo, click and clack. What a delight. You guys are a dream team, and I'm a strength zealot, Marcus. And I use strengths-based approaches in my coaching practice, but also talk a lot to teachers and parents about how to bring out strengths in their kids. And how do you see, if at all, your new book kind of working into that model? I recommend everybody to do Strengths Finder and look at how to discover your strengths and look at strengths lists and things, but do you see that the new book, and I'm a teacher stimulator, how might that work into helping parents and teachers bring out the strengths in themselves and the kids?
Well, yeah, and that's a huge one, isn't it? If you look at Gen Y and you ask Gen Y the question, I know you might be talking about even younger kids, so Gen, what do they call it now, Gen Z, Gen Viral. But let's go with Gen Y. I thought Gen Y would be a very strengths-focused generation because it is, you know, with Facebook and the Twitters and the Tumblrs and the YouTubes. I mean, it is a very self-involved generation that is kind of intrigued by itself. I thought if you posed them the question, which do you think will help you be most effective in life, building on your strengths or fixing your weaknesses? I thought they would be a very strengths-focused generation. It turns out that they are, in fact, the most remedial of all generations.
Really?
If you pose Gen Y that question, yeah, 27% of Gen Yers, that's people under 26 or 7. If you do a representative sample of that group, 27% of them go with strengths. All the rest of them are going with fixing their weaknesses. It could, to some extent, just be youth, because I don't have that data from 25 years ago for Gen X.
Interesting.
But
yeah.
I think it's also, we do in schools, we do teach children and students that the way to succeed in life is to find your gaps and plug them. And so we have an entire school system that there is no national curriculum at all to help a child of, say, 11 or 12 go, by the way, first of all, the concept is that you're unique and enduringly so, and that we have to find what's unique about you and turn it into something useful. That concept is not really taught in a national curriculum, nor is there any way to give a child a coherent language to begin to describe for themselves, you know, describe stories for themselves around how their strengths play in practice. So we end up with a bunch of people graduating now flooding into the workplace who are, you'd have to say, at the very least, confused about what it's going to take for them to, about what it's going to take for them to excel in the workplace. So I think, to your point, Gloria, first of all, it's a big problem because we haven't taught our incoming workforce around this at all. I think the place to begin, if you've got a kid who's 15, then you can give them standout no problem at all. As Dan will attest, the questions aren't arcane. They're pretty basic scenarios that any 15-year-old could probably relate to. Beyond that, I think there's just really simple things you could do with a 12-year-old. I mean, you can give them a blank sheet of paper and say, look, if you want to really think together about how to win in school, how you can excel in school and where you can, take this blank sheet of paper, draw a line down the middle of it, right? Loved it at the top of one column, loathed it at the top of another column, and just take it around with you for this week. And anytime you find yourself looking forward to something or losing yourself, and scribble it down. And anytime you find yourself really pushing something away and dreading it, and then you'll end up at the end of the week with this list of activities, and it will at least give you something for you and your child to talk about. It'll give you a starting point. There's so much more we should do in the area of education. I'm passionate about it. I just haven't figured out the right way to execute on that passion.
Thank you, Gloria, for the great question. You'll get a free copy of Marcus's new book, Standout, which came out this week. Marcus, I think that one, you know, as you know, and maybe I'm validating my advisor street cred here, in that, you know, I tend to like things that are quick and actionable, that work, that don't take, you know, enormous amounts of time. And this loved it, loathed it idea for kids is brilliant. As Marco was saying, take a I mean, it's funny. The producer here in our Washington D.C. studio is the woman to whom I've been married for 16 years, also known as Mrs. Office Hours. And when you said that, Mrs. Office Hours wrote that down, drew a box and an arrow around it, and then put another one, and put the words "Pink Kids" and another arrow to it. And pink was with a capital P, so it wasn't kids who were colored pink, it's kids who are our progeny, because it's a great, great idea, and it's a really simple thing to do. And I think the more kids begin that vocabulary of what do they like, where are they strong, they end up doing better and becoming better versions of themselves. So I love that idea. We're going to go to
And one quick distinction on that, Dan.
Oh, yeah.
What they're taught to learn about in school is what you're good at versus what you're bad at. That's what you get graded on. And so
right.
You're taught from a very early age, that's what school's all about. And your strengths are then become synonymous with what you're good at. And yet all of us know people who've become lawyers because they were good at pre-law, and then they end up hating being a lawyer. Or they become doctors because they were good at all the pre-med stuff, and yet they end up hating sick people. So we have to help a child really early on realize that what you're good at is performance. And there's going to be some subjects that you get A's in that drain you and bore you. And while that's good and you should do that, performance is good, nonetheless there's an antecedent to that, and that you, the child, you have all the answers to this. Your teachers don't have the answers to this. You know which activities draw you in and engage you. You know which activities bore you and repel you. And they are not the same one child to another. You know that with the pink kids. I know that with the Buckingham kids. We know the kids are different, and kids have access to that information if we just gave them a simple way in the course of a week to start paying attention to which activities you're drawn to and which repel you. What you're saying to the child is, you know the answers to this. Not the answers forever in your life, but we can start right here, right now, with some stuff that you know about you that I don't, and I'm your dad. So let's start there.
Fantastic. That's a great, great takeaway. I want to go to I'm going to take a question off of Twitter because we're getting some here. But let's Jessica, do you want to go to J.R. Meredith in Roselle, Illinois? J.R., you're on the line with Marcus. J.R., are you there?
Oh, hi. It's Joy again. I already asked a question, but it's Joy.
Oh, you did?
Meredith.
Wait.
I asked the first question. So,
I'm sorry. Oh, you already asked a Twitter question. Hey,
yes,
okay.
I did. So
okay,
I guess
you
I could ask another question, and that would be just to throw it out.
You know what? Let's make it more fair. Thank you. I didn't realize that, Joy. That's just a weird glitch. We're going to go to one of your colleagues or one of your homeboys or girls in Chicago now. B. Waters in Chicago. You're on with Marcus.
Yeah, you've both mentioned earlier the strengths of like creativity and communication, and it reminded me of a New York Times op-ed I read that was from a few years ago, and it said 81% of people think they have a book in them, but the author of the op-ed said essentially they shouldn't bother trying to write it. It was a pretty cynical view of writing, but I think now that I have the opportunity to speak to two best-selling authors on the line, I was curious if you have any advice or insight about that and the writing publishing process. I guess I'm curious, like, are the cards stacked against us because of the way writing and publishing world has changed in recent years? Any kind of insight for the creatives and communicators out there who think they have a book within them?
All right,
well,
thanks for that question. Marcus, you want to take a shot at it?
Yeah, I have two quick thoughts. One is I don't have Dan's books in me. I have my books in me.
So I think, first of all, I wouldn't agree that most of us don't have a book in us. I think one of my first pieces of work I ever did was interviewing the world's best housekeepers at Walt Disney World, and you listen to them describe the way in which you clean a room, and you might think that's the most tedious thing in the world. For them, there was so much creativity and variety and insight into the way they did that. It was like an art. You get anyone deep on their subject, and it's riveting. So you find the subject that you have depth and power and passion around, and obviously you need to learn the craft of being able to write about it, but there is variety and insight and story there for all of us if we pay attention. Second, I think just practically or structurally within the publishing world, frankly, I think the world has turned much more away from the publishing houses toward every individual being able to find a way, an outlet for their writing, for their attention, whether it's microblogging or blogging or whether it's self-publishing. There is, with the rise of ebooks and e-readers, there's just so much more opportunity for you to get your attention and the stories that derive from it out there to readers than ever there was before, in my view.
I absolutely agree with that second point. I think that there are more outlets today than there ever have been. It's actually quite extraordinary that you can set up a blog about something that you're particularly interested in, and it instantly becomes available to everyone on the planet. That is an extraordinary thing, and the gatekeepers have far less of a say. So I think that if someone out there really wants to write a book or get their ideas heard, there are many more opportunities today than there ever have been. That's one side of it. The other side of it is, and I've had this conversation before, I think that there are a lot of people out there who want to have written a book. And that's a very different thing from writing a book. Writing a book is as laborious, excruciating, difficult an exercise as you can find in the first world. It is, if you'll pardon my coarse language here, I have discovered that writing a book is much more ass than head. That is, you have to show up and show up the next day, and show up the next day, and show up the next day. It's really hard work. It's really laborious. It takes a really long time. It's hard to make progress. You can't do it instantly. And I think that a lot of people don't want to deal with that. And so, but if you're willing to deal with that kind of drudgery of showing up every day, then I think that your opportunity to have your voice heard is greater now than it ever has been. Let me offer a great book on that. For those of you aspiring writers, there's a great book by Stephen Pressfield called The War of Art that makes this case a little bit more compellingly than I just did. We're going to take a Twitter question here from Justin. And I think Justin, where is Justin? I think Justin's in New York City. He has an interesting question about, is he in New York City? Yes, he's in New York City. Justin Mass in New York City asked via Twitter. He says, how important is it to balance diverse strengths when assembling an agile team? I guess to rephrase that, it's that how do we reckon with strengths when we assemble a team?
Yeah, well, one of the other reasons why we built a standout was because we wanted to give managers what we called a manager team report, so that you could, if you had all of your 10 people take standout, you could have a dashboard and you could immediately and quickly see each of the people on your team and what are their top two strengths roles were, and then have an individualized cheat sheet.
Oh, interesting. Uh-huh.
On how to focus you, how to reward you and engage you. I mean, if you're an advisor and I want to get you excited about change, then I would say to you, Dan, this change is going to make the world, it's going to be a better way of doing things. It'll be more effective. It'll be more...
It's going to work better,
It's going to work better. Now, if you're with me and you're a stimulator, my lead is stimulator, then you're going to say to me, Mark, it's just going to be more fun. It's going to be more dramatic. It's going to be more exciting. So even in terms of something like change, there's different language that a manager's got to use to get the best from their team. So we wanted a simpler way than StrengthsFinder. StrengthsFinder really was for the individual, and to some extent StandOut kind of for the manager, because it does give you this really short, sharp, focused way of getting the best from your team. On the point of diversity, it's funny. The best team in the world right now, the best team by far in the world right now, is the Barcelona soccer team. And they are dominating their sport in a way that no other professional team is dominating their sport in any sport. And if you look at them, they're all the same physiology. They're all about 5'8" and fast. Now, the theory would be that actually in soccer, you need to have some really tall people who can head the ball away, and you need a balanced diversity of team members of the team. But actually, what has happened with Barcelona is they've chosen to play a very particular kind of soccer, very fast, short passes, which they teach from a very young age at like 13 or 14 in their school called La Masia, just outside of Barcelona. And they teach where you pass the ball, you move, you offer, pass, move, offer, pass, move, offer. And they've therefore got a team which is incredibly imbalanced. Everyone's basically got the same skill set or same set of talents or strength. And they win. Why do they win? Because they've picked a particular strategy or approach, and then they've built their team to execute to that approach to perfection. To the point where when they played in the Champions League last year against the second best team in the world, it was an utter crushing of Manchester United. Mm. So it ain't necessarily so that the best teams are full of diverse strengths. What is true is that you have to have the strengths that fit your particular approach. You should probably select for that. And then as a manager, what is true is you should absolutely know what particular configuration of strengths you have. It doesn't have to be balanced. You don't need a representative of every one of these nine strengths roles. You just better know what you've got so you can
right.
maximize it.
That's very, very interesting. Do you want to go to the phones? We're going to go to Cam Mitchell in Cam Mitchell, whoever you are, in beautiful Austin, Texas. Mitchell or Cam, are you on the line? Hey, Mitchell or Cam, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I sure can. Are you Cam or are you Mitchell?
Mitchell.
Mitchell, welcome to Office Hours. What's your question for Marcus?
He's assessing a lot of these corporations, and they're doing the, say, the entire company, they're taking the strengths test. Does a corporate culture emerge that the top five would come out for the firm?
You mean if a particular company deliberately was selecting for a certain set of strengths, would that come out in the firm? I think it depends on the size of the firm. I mean, within my firm, within my company, when you look at our, let's take our standout results, you look at the standout results of the people that work for me in my company, TMBC, which stands for the Marcus Buckingham Company, because we have huge creativity in my company, you do see that we don't have a single pioneer. There's no pioneers on our team. Pioneer is one of the strengths roles, which is a fascination with what's new, what's next. And you do, my company probably does have we aren't people who are constantly bringing in the next greatest new gadget, and maybe we should be. So probably, yes, a company is a function of the individuals that it's chosen to select for. And in that sense, bringing on board some people who are perhaps different than the current executive team would be of help. At least we certainly at TMBC need to know that we are absent that particular strength and need to either manage around it or hire against it. I have seen incredibly successful companies, and we do an awful lot of work for one of our clients is Facebook, and if you look at the executive team at Facebook, they are quite similar, actually, both in their in their strengths roles. Is that a good thing? Well, you know, they have a certain kind of style and vibe to them, and they've made some gaffes, I suppose, with some of the privacy decisions and had to explain them away. But, boy, they've been extraordinarily successful at leveraging their very unique set of strengths that they have as an exec team, and they seem to work incredibly well together, not least because with a whole bunch of similar strengths, I know it's counterintuitive or rather counter-conventional wisdom because we're supposed to have a bunch of really different people on a team. It does speed things up. If you have a bunch of people with the same strengths, there's no misunderstandings. You're all speaking the same language. So there's a certain power to that kind of homogeneity, actually.
That's an interesting point because there is a kind of conventional view about, you know, we need diverse teams. There's an inherent power in diversity. But both with your Barcelona example or simply knowing what cards you have, it's actually another fascinating and very compelling way to look at that. We have time for one more question, it looks like. We're going to go to Stephen Sachs in Del Mar, California. Stephen Sachs, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. That was one of the bigger surprises, listening to you going to the last question. Just as a quick aside on what you were just talking about, isn't isn't it also possible that that kind of, not conformity, although I don't, in some ways you could label it conformity, but that type of unity of vision or unity of strength can lead to some very serious blindsides or some very serious, some gaffes. Specifically, for instance, the Facebook privacy blunder.
Yes, I mean, it can. I think you know, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. So you get a lot of speed and acceleration, and
yeah.
The speed of Facebook works is extraordinary, and yet you will have blindsides. So having said that, though, the knee-jerk to say, well, we should all be different on this exec team,
mm-hmm.
I've worked with enough exec teams to know that doesn't always lead to increased performance at all. It sometimes just leads to misunderstanding and confusion. So long as you have knowledge of what you've got, you're ahead. Because if you think about it, what you really want is you want to gate into somebody else's garden. If Dan's an advisor equalizer, and I'm not, by the way, then at the very least, I need a way to get into his garden and go, okay, those are cool. Those are useful. This is how I might be able to talk to him. This is how he's going to learn. This is the way in which I can get him excited. And then he's got to have some way into my garden to go, okay, well, Marcus isn't just trying to be a jerk about this. He's actually just behaving out of the source of his strength.
Right.
So knowledge can be that gate into somebody else's approach or somebody else's garden in that metaphor. Having said that, you know, having a bunch of people with the same sort of approach is faster. And yes, you'll have some blind sides, but you'll also have the upside of acceleration and speed.
And my guess is that if you are aware of what you have, that gets you a big way there. I mean, there are all kinds of stories of groupthink that had tragic consequences, like Vietnam. But there was a huge lack of self-awareness there as well. And so I think if you say, hey, we're all looking at this from the same perspective, that's going to give us advantages of speed and of unity. But we need to watch for our blind side and occasionally check it. Maybe that's a way to do it. I just think that what's interesting here is really challenging this notion that that diverse teams are inherently more valuable. That's an empirical question, actually. And we can't have that knee-jerk response. Great, great point, Marcus. Okay, so we're at the top of the hour here, unfortunately, and we're going to leave a lot of people hanging on the phone, and I'm really sorry about that. Dozens of people wanted to get in here, and we're not going to have time for that. So my apologies for that. If you we're going to give away 24 copies of Marcus's book, this new book, Standout. It's a great new book. It has a really cool, groundbreaking strength assessment that we've been talking about, and the book comes with the key. So it's just great. So I encourage you to get it. But 24 of you are going to get it for free, thanks to the good graces of Marcus's publisher. So if you have, if you asked a question, if you were on the air, please send an email to this address. Get ready, this address. Or if you asked a question via Twitter that we went to, this address, mccullpink@mac.com. mccullpink@mac.com. That's mccullpink@mac.com. And just tell colleague Elizabeth that you were once somebody who asked a question. Give us your address and we'll send you this book for free. That's going to give us some extra copies here. So if you would like an extra copy, send an email to Elizabeth at that same address, mccullpink@mac.com, and we're going to have a drawing for the remainder. So you're entered into a drawing. That's, I think, the fairest way that we can do that. So let's wrap up here. Marcus Buckingham, thanks so much for being with us on Office Hour. It was a great hour. I think we've learned a lot.
Not at all. I loved it. I'll be happy to do it again. It was a lot of fun. And I love it.
Month. No, we won't get you on next month. So good luck. So good luck with the book. You have been listening to Office Hours. We post our recordings on danpink.com very quickly after each broadcast. You can also find this program in our previous episodes with other great guests on iTunes. So just look for Dan Pink or Daniel Pink's Office Hours on iTunes, and you can find it there. You have been listening to Office Hours, ladies and gentlemen. thanks so much for being with us. We're going to make an announcement about